All right, everybody, welcome back to another exciting episode of South Sudan and the World, where we have great conversation with inspiring individuals making a mark in the fields in South Sudan and the world. I'm your host, Akol Doc. Today, we have a very distinguished guest with us. It's a pleasure to introduce Nelson Kwaje, a technologist, a human rights campaigner with over 7 years of experience in ICT and digital advocacy, 100 most influential young Africans in 2020 by the Africa Youth Awards. You've seen him at CNES Hub. You see me at Atlanta Technologies, but today you hear from him. Welcome to the show, Nelson.
Thanks, Akol. It's a delight being here.
Yes. Thank you for joining us. You have such a great stature. You have such a great personality. You've done such great work. Tell us a bit about your background and your upbringing, your childhood.
Thanks so much, Akol. My name is Nelson Kwaje. I am a South Sudanese. I'm 32 years old. I was born in Khartoum, and then one Sudan, two South Sudanese parents. My dad was an aid worker. He spent all his kind of professional life working as an aid worker. He started his job using a high school diploma. I think by then they call it a high school diploma or like a high school certificate. And my mom, basically, she is a housewife. Yeah, so that's where I was born. I grew up in Sudan, in Khartoum, for the first 19 or 20 years of my life, basically roaming around a few states in Sudan. Then later on, moved back to South Sudan, then to Kenya for 7 years, then back to South Sudan again.
Okay, so your paths intersect between East Africa and Sudan, which is quite unique. How did you get involved into technology? How did you develop this passion for technology?
I had started very early on. I mean, depends how early on it is. I had started back in 2007, 2008, 2006, 2007. My dad had someone gifted him a laptop, an old laptop. And by then, like, laptops were not that common. So I got interested in this device and started doing a lot of work with the laptop. But primarily, I kind of became like the neighborhood geek, mostly like selling or giving pirated software. I mean, people know, like, in Africa, pirated software is a thing. Pirated software, pirated games, downloading movies, music. So that's how I got my path into technology. And I really like, I kind of explored everything that needs to be explored using a laptop offline. Afterwards, I also got interested a bit into with the advent of social media with platforms like MySpace and Facebook, 2008. That's when it's kind of started becoming a bit popular in Sudan by then. So I was also like one of the early, the early adopters of social media in Sudan by then. And I think I was just very fascinated by the bit. And I spent a lot of my time, my early years, kind of downloading songs to people. I'm not downloading songs from the internet. By then, downloading songs, you have songs in your hard drive and then you sell them to people. And I kind of like got a lot of money from that in my early years. I think that's how I got into technology. And then later on, I joined architecture school and I did architecture for 1 year. Then I dropped out, then found my way back again into studying IT in Kenya.
Okay, so you wanted to be an architect.
By then, I kind of like, because I finished high school, I was probably 17 or 18, and I just wanted to get into uni. And like by then, like IT wasn't there that much, but then like architecture school was open, and then I was just like, yeah, let me do it. But I just realized pretty early on that I was like, that's not going to work for me. I was doing well in class, but then like I saw people who are so exceptionally good that I was like, I'm never going to be like a star in this field by any way, shape or form. They're like people who are really good in kind of drawing, doing all this stuff. I was just like, okay, I will be an average person in this field. So I did 1 year, then I dropped out. Yeah, I was like, that's not going to work for me.
And so what was your first, I would say, official exposure to technology in your adult life?
So my first official exposure to technology was back in South Sudan. So early in 2012, I had started becoming a bit proficient in now like professional use of technology, primarily like Microsoft packages. I became very proficient in Microsoft Excel, Word, and PowerPoint. And then I realized a lot of people wanted my services in that, primarily to help them set up things, like set up like PowerPoints, do budget or what, and also do trainings. So I earned a lot of money training people. So, I mean, not a lot, it's a kind of reasonable amount of money and doing typing. Like, yeah, there are a lot of professional people in South Sudan who are good in their job, like lawyers, engineers and what, but they don't know computers. So I kind of became the aid between them and computerized systems. So some people will come like, hey, I want to do this bill of quantity, type it up for me, do for me all the things. Hey, I want to write these letters. I want to do this contract. I have a presentation. So that kind of like gave me an early, and then doing a lot of computer repair, like software repair, like installing systems and stuff like that. That was my early exposure, and gave me, that kind of gave me the drive to now go into like studying IT, because I was like, okay, you know what? The first time I kind of got into higher education, I just went for it. But now I know what I want to study. I want to study this thing called IT. And that's how I kind of like went back to school, and but this time in Kenya.
Okay. Also, originally you were going to school in Sudan.
Yes, originally I was going to school in Sudan, architecture school in Sudan. And then in between that, there was like the split of the country. In between my first year of university and me dropping out, there was that split of a country.
So you got to deal with that. And then you ended up going to studying IT.
Yes, yes. I ended up going to study IT in Kenya now.
Okay, that's good. Well, some of your work has really transcended borders. When you read some of the things you've done work in Ethiopia, US. Can you tell us briefly about some of your work in Africa and in the world?
Yeah, so as I told you, I studied IT. So I kind of like pretty much did computer networks, and I also did a lot of work on kind of web content systems and stuff like that. But then from the year 2013, I realized, like, with the kind of the start of the war, the conflict in South Sudan, I realized pretty much early on, like, hey, there's an intersection between technology and conflict, especially in terms of content, hate speech and incitement to violence. So I got into this field, which is called civic tech. So kind of the intersection of human rights and technology. So I was kind of like one of the early people in South Sudan to kind of explore this field, in terms of that data analysis, content moderation, and mitigating hate speech and incitement to violence and harm online. So I started with a project called Defy Hate Now. I joined them initially as a social media analyst, then later on as a trainer, a program manager, and then I became the director of the organization in South Sudan. So kind of leading pretty much a big chunk of our work. And I kind of led and pioneered our work on fact-checking in South Sudan. So like launching the fact-checking platform 211 Check, which is kind of the de facto fact-checking, publicly facing fact-checking platform in South Sudan, part of the International Fact-Checking Network, and certified a fact-checking institute platform. I also founded SafetyCom, which is the cyber safety hotline, basically, and cyber safety platform in South Sudan. And it's also like the kind of the only publicly facing cyber safety platform in South Sudan. It responds to a lot of incidents across the country. And then through that work, I kind of got a reputation for working on this, the intersection of this work. So I got one of the two areas that I kind of like went and worked on is like I did a similar project and work. Initially, I kind of was involved in setting up in Cameroon early in 2019, 2020. So I set up and I worked on the framework for Defy Hate Now together with a team in Cameroon, the framework for mitigating hate speech and fact checking in Cameroon. So I set up a fellowship program there together with our team. So I was kind of consulted, help in that. And then also during the Tigray crisis, that's 2021, I've also done a similar work with Meta in Ethiopia. Basically, at the onset, you know, there was an initial election that was supposed to happen. That election was disputed. The process towards the election was kind of like a bit not clear. And that led to a very open war between the Tigrayan government and the Ethiopian federal government. As a result of that, there was a lot of harmful content. So I was running a project at that time in Ethiopia. So primarily setting up system for also for a very large, on behalf of a very large social media company, seeing how they can monitor the toxic content online and how they can respond fast, and also with civil society and content experts in Ethiopia. Those are kind of like a lot of the stuff of the work. I have done the similar work also in Uganda and also in Kenya, and also on conflict mitigation and kind of doing a online response. Now, that is mostly like my on-ground work, but I get consulted a lot on issues to do with digital social media and conflict in the continent. On the Sudan crisis, I had written one or two papers, mostly not publicly facing, but like a lot of consultation papers for social media companies on how to respond to the conflict. What is the nature of the content online? How groups are shaping the discussion online in regard to the conflict? So pretty much everything hands-on on this I've been involved in.
One of the things that you have been doing in South Sudan is the issue of fact-checking. And this is something new to many South Sudanese. The issue of fact-checking became a very prevalent issue during the conflict, as you saw the rise of misinformation, the rise of hate speech, and also the rise of people using social media as a political tool. Did you face any backlash from people who didn't understand what you were doing when you were setting these things up and countering hate speech?
Of course I did. I think when you're doing fact checking, one of the things that we faced earlier on is a lot of people think they don't understand what fact checking does. So fact checking is about like really trying to fact check things that are of public interest worthiness. And that's the interesting thing. A lot of people think like we fact check everything. So at times when we don't pay attention to something, people are like, oh, you are biased, you are selective, you just after the government or after whatever people. Because the thing is that you, okay, what can you fact check? Can you fact check everything? Should you fact check anything that someone says? Satire, jokes, people say things that people discuss under the tree? No. What do you want to do? We do fact checking as far as it's concerned, as far as the public discourse is concerned. How do we fact check information that can make the public discourse healthy? A healthy public discourse is one that is based on facts, that is productive, that leads progress and development. So earlier on, a lot of people didn't understand because people wanted like, hey, like there's this gossip about this person, there is this. We're like, we don't do this. We have a criteria for fact checking. And initially we focused mainly on COVID-19. And we got a lot of backlash, especially from government officials. Some people felt that we were kind of attacking their characters. Media houses felt that we were like, why are we going after them? Because I remember there's a time that media houses will just take any stock photo from the internet and say like, hey, cattle raiding in Jongle. And then a photo is from something that happened in Mali. And that's like reputable media houses. And we were like, hey, like this picture is not from what happened there. If you want to use it, you need to really make it very clear that so that you're not implicitly misleading people. Yeah, but we got a lot of backlash. And also one of the problems that we face, people think I personally run the editorial decisions for the fact checking, which is actually not true. We have editor and then we have a group of people who actually run this, like based on consensus, and they have a policy that they follow and they also give you a chance to reply back and all these things. But a lot of times people, like when an organization get fact checked or someone comes, a story is published about them, they come to me personally. Yeah, this Nelson Kwajie guy thinks he's this and this and this. And it's a very difficult process to try to explain it to the people.
So some of the work you've done has put you in the spotlight.
Yeah.
Many people see the work you do at Defy Hate, the work you do at Seniors Hub, which we'll discuss shortly. Were you surprised to notice how you became a public figure so quickly? Did you anticipate this? Or did it just come about?
It really came about. I think during the COVID, it's very interesting. You know, in South Sudan is a lot of the referencing you get from outside because the people who are in the field know my work. And especially like these people who invite me to global conferences and what, they really know my work. But South Sudanese don't know my work. I remember when my name popped up in the 100 most influential list, the comments, I usually don't go and reply to comments, especially like on public news portals. But my brother has a lot of time, my younger brother. So he goes, hey, why are you being a hater? The response from a lot of South Sudanese were like, who is this guy? How is he influential? What has he done to me? Is he political? Has he produced anything that we have seen? And I think that's kind of like, that's a bit of the very interesting thing. I think like my work is probably like, I'm like kind of like a chef. I'm in the kitchen. Most of the time when you receive food, you probably thank the waiter or the waitresses or the people whom you interface with. But my work is usually like two steps behind the public. My work on fact checking, you barely kind of like, you don't see that even on the organization. My work on cyber safety, most of the time when people interact, they don't see my face. And even at seniors, it's that like, so a lot of the times it's the, I don't have a very tangible product that someone can consume and see my name on it. So is I was very surprised by the public nature of my name when it kind of like popped up. It's a very hard thing to manage. If you're an artist, when someone comes to you, they take a picture with you, they go home, they listen to your song. But if you're someone like me, I'm almost like in a Kardashian state where like people kind of know me, but then they don't know what to save for seniors. They don't know what product of mine they can kind of associate with my name. So it's a bit of it's a very tricky public facing portfolio.
Okay. You mentioned that you were one of the 100 most influential young Africans in 2020 by the African Youth Awards. How was that experience like? How did you feel when you got the news? And how was the experience of being in such a prestigious list?
To be honest, it gives you a lot of, imposter syndrome. It's too much, to be honest with you. It's too much for someone like me because I always don't take myself, especially my public facing platform, with that level of seriousness. And I think I didn't realize what it is until I saw the people who are on the list. Talk about Mo Salah, Sadio Mane, Burna Boy, Joe Boy, like name them. Like a lot of people who, that's what I was telling you earlier, a lot of people who have huge public, yeah, I think by then Sadio Mane had won the AFCON. Like there are a lot of people, Mo Salah was doing like the best, Burna Boy, name them. So this guy, actually my name was next to this guy. This, there was this song called Jerusalem for this Mr. KG something. So there were like a lot of people. And then my siblings, you are the ones who are bringing this to me because they're like, yeah, So they're like, hey, do you know that there's Burna Boy there? Do you know that it's who there? Do you know that it's this, that it's this? But also you get a lot of, there are people who know you, people who know your work, who have worked with you. They're like, yeah, we expected you to be there. We are not surprised because we know the quality of your work. We have seen you. We know your ethics. We know your work ethics. We know your integrity. You deserve to be there. And I think that is the kind of statement probably that you want to hear, especially from people who know you, who are close to your work. Public statements, public opinion is important, but at times you shouldn't pay as much attention to it. Yeah, because it can also move the other direction.
Yeah, that's something that I've always told people is that if you allow the being on the public's face to impact you and make your decisions, you're going to go crazy. Because there's going to be two types of people. There's going to be people who really, really love you and you're going to be really awkward around them. Like, why do you love me so much? There's going to be people who hate you for no reason. There's going to be people who maybe are going to dig up stuff about you that you've done in your past that's not relevant. There's going to be people who try to defame you. There's going to be people who try to associate you in ways that is not credible or relevant. But do you think that sometimes the level of education affects how South Sudanese view public figures and influencers?
Definitely. I think, the level of education and also information literacy. I think a lot of people, there are people even who are educated, but they're not like information literate. A lot of times, most things are two Google search away from you, but people rarely do that. Like people consume information as they come to them, but they never consume information that they want to get. And that's why they find platforms shaping opinions, because like there are a lot of things that are, like a lot of things are kind of reachable. Even if you want to understand what is the humanitarian budget for South Sudan, who is what, who is the president of what this, what is the budget even for South Sudan? Like a lot of this info is available there, but people don't consume that hardcore kind of like information and data. People want info that comes to them. And I think that kind of impacts and shapes public consumption of information. But then the other thing is also like, you really need to know who are the role models in South Sudan. In South Sudan, basically primarily role modeling in this country has become into like about like, who has the most flashy things, who has the most money, who has the most power,
yes,
especially when youth leadership. So you find the people who have the mic or who have the microphone don't have the factual information that will build the youth. And the people who have the factual information don't have that kind of public mic. Like if you look at this podcast, it might not probably be viewed like 200,000 times, but you know, you go there right now on Facebook, there is a Facebook live that goes for an hour full of insults, but it has like 200,000 views. So So I think in terms of South Sudan, like what is shocking is what the youth want. And a lot of people understood that. A lot of these people who flaunt money or pretend to have some level of influence, some level of caste, some level of flashiness, the youth gravitate towards them, because everyone thinks that they're going to be that.
But I think that's also a predicament of the economic situation, where we live in a country where somebody will graduate college, have spent 4 or 5 years in college, come to South Sudan and see the economic situation. They have trouble getting jobs, they have trouble getting work. And so immediately they gravitate to somebody who they meet, didn't go to school, didn't finish high school, and they're driving a V8. They're building a building. You know, they have a relationship with an uncle or a cousin or a relative or somebody in a position of power who gave them projects. So what happens is people believe that by gravitating towards these people, there's something to be benefited from it. But it's a very short-term thinking, because if you are somebody who are building yourself in the long term, you are aware that the skills and the reputation and the image that you're building now will benefit you in the future. Because right now, the things we're doing as young people, we're not in a rush, but there's young people who are in a rush. I mean, there's people who are 23, 24 who want to be millionaires. I mean, my God, build yourself, do something. So then you get a generation of people who don't have skills, who don't have talents that they've cultivated. What they've cultivated is being followers of somebody. And I think that's testament to the kind of culture that we've developed. Because now, like you said, many Facebook live posts, you see them, the insults, the Mama Amiras, they're celebrities. People, everybody knows them. But if you go and you say, hey, guys, you know, do you guys know what those of Nelson Khwaja did to fight hate speech and how what the role of hate speech is? I said, what the hell is that? But I think society has always been sensationalist, and I always push back on people and say, well, you go to the US, TMZ is very popular. All they do is just kalam farak. They just bring gossip. This person was with who, he's with this and she's with this, and people gravitate to that. But if you go to more technical or more beneficial media like The Economist or other types of media, nobody cares about the GDP analysis. Nobody cares about the budget. Nobody cares about what's going on, but they resort to speculation. And so I think that is a challenge that we've had, but it's also a product of the society. And so some of the things that you have done, particularly with the society, is you have the CNES Hub. Many people don't understand the CNES Hub. So to some of our listeners, what is the CNES Hub and what is your objective with the CNES Hub?
So CNES Hub it's an innovation hub. We exist in South Sudan, and the aim of it is to create a platform. So the hub focuses on three main things, entrepreneurship, art, and technology. So we have, we run an open space here in Juba. Open space in a sense, I usually tell people we are open sense in a sense of like physically open, like we open from morning until evening, but we are also thought open space. I mean, to bring a lot of people in terms of thought provoking and stuff like that. We have over 300 members. And on a daily basis, we have like about 50 of them who come through the hub. So this was kind of like anywhere from artists, entrepreneurs, students, and all the rest. So the idea with it is really to subsidize the cost of doing. And I think that's the biggest idea with CNES Hub. You know, like there are a lot of people who want to do. And doing is a very important thing. And that is necessarily, actually, I use the word doing because it doesn't imply necessarily you have to do something huge or purposeful or what, but you want to do something to progress yourself. This could be launching a book, could be learning an instrument, learning how to use a computer, doing a project, starting a company, all that. A lot of the spaces in South Sudan are hostile to the youth. By hostile, I don't mean like chase the youth, but like they're really geared towards making money. All our public spaces are kind of getting sucked in into that. They're either privatized or kind of move to the other direction. And that increases the cost of doing. So you can't, if you don't have money, you can't move from your house and go somewhere and spend about 3 or 4 hours in a very dignified way without paying, without buying expensive drinks and what. So the whole idea, and it's even with even like events, like what if you are a group of 5 or 10 young people who want to start doing a play? You don't necessarily have money, but you want to start that and you want to test it also. Sometimes you could be having money, but you also want to test it, want to have an audience. So the whole idea with CNES Hub is to do that. Once we do it, then we have a programmatic approach, especially towards entrepreneurship, innovation and acceleration. How do we bring people who have ideas, give them the training necessary and give them the connection through our network so that they can build sustainable businesses? Because that's what we need in this country to develop. We need sustainable businesses that employ people. So that is what the Hub has been doing. But mostly probably really what we are known for is our events and our social gatherings. Like we have the movie nights, the karaoke, which is happening right now, the karaoke nights. We have the poetry evenings, the discussions, all those things kind of constitute the community of seniors.
Yes. Okay. And so what would you say to people who are interested in joining the Hub? What are the benefits of being a member of this Hub?
I think really the Hub is having like the network. So once you come into the Hub, you get access to like a huge network and also a huge part of activity.
Thank you, Nelson, for explaining the Seniors Hub. Now, what would you say to some of our listeners around the world who are South Sudanese, and how can somebody join?
Yeah, so the joining one is actually very straightforward. It depends on the level of engagement. If you just want to attend the events, really follow our social media, Seniors Hub on Twitter, Facebook, and IG. So, and also we have a WhatsApp group. So as soon as you kind of get in touch with this avenues, you'll be able to be added to the WhatsApp group. You receive updates and the rest. This is kind of like on the peripheral kind of engagement. Once you kind of get in touch with our events, then our community managers can now guide you into what kind of communities will you want to be engaged in within seniors. Some people actually rent offices here. We have private offices, dedicated desk and the rest. And some people just work from the community space and also join the other groups that are here. The benefits are really many. It depends on what you want to make use of it. We have a very rich network. We bring a lot of knowledge leaders and thought leaders here. Yesterday, we hosted the Basketball Federation president here, talk about sports and youth development in the country. We host government ministers. We host development practitioners. All these people, we try to connect them here to create a knowledge pool and to create a network effect for everyone. We are also very much in touch in terms of resources, like as simple as accessing a device or internet, or as big as seeking funding and getting like business advice. So it depends on what kind of tier of engagement someone wants to get into. Yeah, but we are available for all these services. Yeah.
So let's say I'm somebody coming from the US, Australia, or Canada, or Europe, and I want a common space to work at for a couple months. Is CNES Hub is a place I can do that? What do I need to do?
So if you want to just come and work from outside space, which is kind of, you have to also sacrifice a bit of privacy because it's a community space. The outside space is open, there are desks, there are like power and internet and stuff. So that one you can just come, chill, work from there. If you want to get a drink from the bar, or you can do that. If you want to get a dedicated space, you can either use one of our dedicated desks. So we have like desks inside the shared offices. This is a closed space with your own privacy. And then there could be like 3 or so other people also who are doing their work, but you can keep everything there. That you can start at like $150, $170 per month. And it's basically plug and play. You just come with your laptop and that is it. Everything else is provided. If you have a company that's mid-sized or startup that you want to get a private office for, we also have those. We have rooms that are dedicated for it. you can rent one of the rooms for anywhere from like $350 to upward of $700. It depends on what you want. So we have people who actually come from abroad and they just take a dedicated desk and they start their work.
Okay, so right now I can get a desk, pay $175, work from there. And there's a restaurant. Also, listen, they make really, really good food there.
Yeah, the restaurants are available for you. Drinks, we have a shared meeting room. So if you want to do a boardroom and a board meeting. Yeah.
And also to my listeners, I've done quite a number of things with the CNS Hub. So this is from my own experience that I've been a part of a lot of discussions. I'm there when there's discussions and forums and conferences. So I really applaud the work that they're doing. And if you are somebody who is in South Sudan, you need to check them out. They're at a new location, which Nelson needs to explain because I keep getting lost. Some of our listeners who are coming from CNS Hub, follow Nelson Kwaje, follow the conversation, the engagement. Also, CNS Hub is in Arabic. You have Arabic and you have English. So Arabic speakers, English speakers, all of you guys are welcome. I want to hear more about your entrepreneurship. You've mentioned quite a number of things where you've learned to basically how to monetize your skills and your potential. And you are an entrepreneur. You have Alayla Technologies. I want to ask you, how do you see technology impacting South Sudan in the future with AI?
Yeah, so as you stated, I actually, I'm an entrepreneur and a technology entrepreneur for that matter. I run Alayla Technologies. I'm an enterprise solution provider here in South Sudan. So we work with several government and private sector actors. There is a lot of opportunity in South Sudan, primarily in terms of work process optimization. I think that's the biggest need right now. Like when you look at South Sudan, there is a lot of loss of efficiency and productivity due to just very, very archaic processes in all kind of fields, from the government processes, to the private sector, all the rest. Even if you want to just like start a business in South Sudan, probably you'll take like a month just collecting documents from different offices, different approvals and all the rest. So there is a very huge opportunity in terms of optimizing processes in South Sudan, and AI can play a very big determinant in that, like in terms of building this system, in terms of doing predictive analytics. So much that can be solved through technology. I know our biggest problem right now is like we have a lot of resistance because not many people are very acquainted with technology, especially people in the workforce, people who lead important things in this country. They are not technology oriented. So as such, the decisions and the investments in this infrastructure and technologies are not coming with the speed at which we want. We are not very isolated from disruption. So there is a lot of disruption that is going to happen. It's already happening with the private sector. It's already happening with development sector. So that is also going to come to the area of South Sudan. We have agriculture, which is a huge opportunity. We have areas of energy and electricity generation, all these things, South Sudan can actually leapfrog the world in terms of reaching the potential. I was reading the other day about small hydro power. So instead of like the initial or the models of the hydro that is being done, that has been done in Sudan and the rest, it is like huge infrastructure and what they're like neo technologies. Even in terms of solar, there is so much technology that can probably meet the demand, the energy demand for South Sudan without the need for those huge infrastructural investments that have been done in other countries. We are definitely open for that. I think what we need now is that catalyst in terms of decision making, in terms of huge public sector investments in fiber, in roads, in the cost of doing business, the cost of energy. And I think those are the biggest things that can kind of lead development. Because if you look at all these countries that had huge leap in terms of development, it started with a big infrastructural and government spending. You look at the US, the projects with DARPA, the projects with the Pentagon, when they open source the GPS, that led to so much development because it was a military purpose, geolocation, geopositioning. But then they opened it up. Out of that, how many technologies have you gotten out of it? Uber, Google Maps, everything that rides on location-based systems kind of rode on that. The same thing with the internet, the submarine cables, all these things. A lot of this technological advancement come at the back of like huge government policy and government investment. Same thing with Kenya. Kenya laid the first submarine cable, I think, which year was it, like prior to 2010. As soon as they did that, that kind of brought so much investment into their country. So I think in South Sudan right now, that is the hindrance. Like we don't have that bold kind of top-down leadership investment that we were leading. Now we're doing that with roads, but I think we need to do that also with technology.
So you mentioned something about the importance of talking with policymakers. You are somebody who's done a lot of work with various government institutions. Alayla Technology has done work for the Ministry of Petroleum, the Central Bank, and the National Communication Authority. What kind of conversation are you having with some of these leaders, some of these ministers, some of these directors and senior officials about the role of technology in development?
I think it's really interesting. So adoption is usually based on need. So when you meet some of these government institutions, you find like, oh, the World Bank required this and this and this compliance mechanism. Oh, how is it done? It needs a certain system. So you find there is a huge rush and acceleration to do that. Oh, we need to connect with this and this and this. What does that need? It needs this system. Then there is a rush for that. Now, that is good because this opens a window for an engagement. Then you can say like, oh, why don't we do this other system? We did the email. Why can't we link it to calendar, chat system, and then payroll automation and stuff like that, and payments? It opens. So there is a lot of opening that is based on need. Now, in some institutions have actually leaders that are kind of have that foresight, and you can see that the opening there is bigger because someone says like, oh, I understand this is what I want, that's how I want, I want to digitize, I want to do what. But it's very rare. And also the problem with South Sudan also is you find that the rate at which people go in and out of office is so high. So it has a HR term, I don't know.
Turnover rate.
Yes. So you find someone has a very good idea, you start a process with them, and the next thing you know that they're not there and there's no continuity. So that's also either that project dies or you need to get a lot of other information. Just within the last 3 years, we had three central bank governors. How many ministers of finance? Almost three or four. So you can imagine like what goes into that. Like if you had a multi-year project that involves digitizing or doing some technological reform, that gets thrown out of the window. And at times it's not even that. It can even be disadvantageous for these institutions because some of these institutions make financial commitment and then afterwards they totally forget about it. They even don't know what is the procurement obligation from the supplier and they go to the next thing. This kind of creates a lot of uncertainty. So I think I'm hopeful with this coming election, with this new kind of legitimacy and mandate, people get a bit of calm and we can have like more years to do probably like proper policy work and work that involves in kind of adoption of technology.
You mentioned a good thing and you said elections. What is the role of technology playing in elections? Are you going to see more hate speech? Are you going to see a lot more need to monitor some of the rhetoric online? And how do you think technology can help in election and also political development? Because we've talked about the private sector. We've talked about what's needed. Mm. But in the political sector, how can technology contribute positively to it?
I had initial discussions with a few policymakers in the past 3 weeks or so, 4 weeks. I'm primarily talking about like, how do we do hotspot mapping and incident response? Because you see, in South Sudan, the biggest problem that we have is really not like, I mean, yes, there is a potential for large-scale conflicts at times, but the pockets of conflict, local conflicts that are spreading across for different grievances is what at times drains a lot of the national agenda. You see right now, even as we're talking, there is a conflict in the small conflicts in Jonglei. We have conflicts the sides of Wau, Western Bahr al-Ghazal states. We have conflicts around Tonj. We have conflicts in Abyei. So you see these small conflicts, at times, they kind of create and galvanize into like a larger issue. And that drains the government resources and even humanitarian effort. So some of the discussions I've been having, like, why don't we do an early warning, early response system? If something says like, hey, there is a movement of youth from this place to this place with this number of ammunition, what is the response there? Who is the person in that place? What is the buffer that can be created in that area? There is this and this conflict that happened in this place. The reasons for it is this. We see rumors of this type. So one of the things we want to see, how do you use technology? How do you use user-generated content in terms of GPS and all this to map and to do response in terms of as a government and also as a humanitarian sector? And I think that's one of the discussions that we're doing, but also like mapping online content also. How do you see trends? What are the trends that is happening, that are happening? How do you respond to it? Like, for example, one of the issues that we have is that a lot of rumors, but the response from the government is slow. So that allows room for such rumors to gain ground and people even panic, run away from their homes and do a lot of things. So technology can play a huge role in terms of kind of mapping and doing response. Either this can be an action response on the ground or response to content and response to rumors. The other thing that technology will also help us with is just like really electioneering process, like awareness process of registration of voters, process for registration of candidates, voter transmission, all these things, technology can help us in trying to gather the information and the data for around those areas. We have a lot of people who are displaced. How are these people going to be part of elections? We have people who are displaced within their states. We have people who are displaced outside their state. We have people who are displaced outside the country. Are we going to make them part of elections? If they are going to be part of an election, which actually should be the prudent thing, what is the process of kind of integrating them into that? There is a huge role also for technology to play there. I've already started discussions with policymakers on this, not necessarily from a point of like, hey, we want to get this contract, but from a point of like, hey, how can we design something that can allow everyone to plug in and to get real-time data and also to be able to progress together with what is happening.
That's very interesting. And I think you bring a new angle that people don't think about, and that's the role of technology in politics. As somebody who is a political science student and a political scientist, one of the things that they used to say in university was that the Obama administration or the Obama campaign in 2008 started using technology. They started getting mailing lists, collecting the data of, okay, we have this many youth, these are their age, here are their educational background. And then they use that information to have an understanding of their base. I think with technology, we can have an understanding of some of the challenges facing people, because if you're able to get information from people and this information is directly from them, it's beneficial. And then also the ability to give people access to information so people are aware of the laws and the regulations of the country, the policies, it helps them to also become better citizens. And one of the biggest things that we see all the time is the Juba City Council. People say, we don't know their laws and their policies. If they had a website or any information place where you can say, here's the taxes, here's the fees, here's the rules, here's the regulation, I don't think you'd have as much confusing as you do now, because somebody will come to you in your shop and say, you haven't paid this, you haven't done that. And you're like, I'm not familiar with that. So I think that this is something we need to promote, especially as young people, to policymakers, that technology is your friend. It's an asset that you can use when it comes to governing. And it's an asset you should not shy away from. And I think that's a big thing. As we wrap up, I want to know, what are some words and inspiration that you have for South Sudanese around the world based on your work?
Yeah. I think yesterday I was talking with Luol Deng, and actually he's one of the most inspirational people. Someone who played basketball at the highest level, someone who ran business at the highest level, rubbed shoulders with the highest, the most famous people in the world, and still come back to the country. And whenever you meet such a person, it really dwarfs all achievements and all ambitions that you have. But you look at that, you're like, oh, I can actually like really focus on that. And that's the idea of like selflessness. We have, especially the young people, we have really grown into the idea of chasing the bag, building empires and stuff like that. The values on selflessness, the values on like really how can you progress a national agenda? How can you uplift other people? These values are not Instagrammable. They're not that much values. And a lot of times what I tell people, South Sudanese across the world, is that we really need to be into the business of national agenda. Look at what the Ethiopians are doing. They were doing fundraising to build their dam. Like, this is crazy. They're not fundraising for a wedding. They're not fundraising for what? They're literally raising money, small dollars, to build a dam, to build a national infrastructural program. I know like that this is a very low time in terms of like national projects and governmental projects because of the corruption and all that. But I think we need to really more value selfless. We need to kind of go back into the value of kind of valuing the country, valuing the ideas of building things that probably might not benefit my immediate needs, even the future needs of mine, but might benefit like people in 10, 15 years. How do we do that? Like, how do we raise a generation that can kind of go beyond? How can we raise people who might not experience the hardship that we experience right now? And I think that's the inspirational statement right now. It's like, really, let's try, especially as young people, let's try to build those. Let's try to build those foundations. Let's try to build platforms. Because for me, that's what cuts across my work. When you see my work with Safetycom, you see my work with 211 Check, my work with Seniors Hub, it's all about building platforms, not building brands, building platforms. How can I build platforms that can uplift other people, that can give people a springboard for them to kind of go to the next level? And I think for me, that's the inspiration. That's the idea, building platforms and uplifting people. Because then you create opportunities. And then you realize other people's potential so that they can kind of like, and usually really pays back. People might disagree with you, with your opinions and what, but rarely do people disagree with your output and your results, because they see it. People see it and they understand it.
So, ladies and gentlemen, selflessness. As we've heard from our brother, Nelson Kwajie, let's have national agenda. Let's do things for the nation. Yes, it's important to build yourself personally in business, get the bag, but also for us to be a strong nation, we have to have a national agenda. And let's not forget about it. Wise words from Nelson Kwajie. Thank you for your insights and your experiences on South Sudan and the world. Nelson, one final word.
I really appreciate the amazing work that you're doing, the excellent. I've been seeing the work that you've been doing. We're so delighted to have someone like you in this country who's leading in a manner that is rarely seen. Yeah, so thank you so much.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you guys are interested in Seniors Hub, you'll find it online. Just look up Seniors Hub. If you're in Arabic, Markaz Seniors. Nelson Kwajie can be found on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, The Journey. Now, let's keep in touch. If you're coming to South Sudan, you know where to find them. Thank you for tuning to South Sudan The World. We hope you found inspiration in this journey and story, in this commitment to this intersection of technology and human development. Until next time, follow me on your social media. I'll call Doc on all social media. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and I just joined Threads. That should be interesting. And let's stay informed and stay engaged. You guys be blessed. I love you guys and stay well.